I want you to picture the world around 300 BC.
Okay.
Alexander the Great has just swept across the known world. He's created this massive, just sprawling empire. This is an era of totally unprecedented expansion. But then Alexander dies.
Right.
And almost overnight, the empire fractures. The stable, sort of cozy world of the Greek city-states where, you know, everyone knew their role and they knew their neighbors, that's just gone.
Completely gone.
Yeah, it's replaced by this chaotic, shifting geopolitical mess. Borders are dissolving, governments are crumbling, and the average person feels really small, unmoored, and just completely at the mercy of these massive external forces.
It's a historical moment that honestly rhymes uncomfortably well with the modern era. I mean, when the world gets too big and too chaotic, people stop asking, you know, how do I participate in politics? And they start asking, how do I survive this without losing my mind?
Exactly. And that is the exact question that gave birth to the subject of today's deep dive. Mm-hmm. We are looking at Dr. Arthur Holmes's lecture on the history of philosophy, specifically focusing on that transition into Stoicism.
Which is such a rich topic.
It really is. Now, I think a lot of people hear the word Stoicism, and they think it's just a mood. Like, you know, the stiff upper lip, don't cry at funerals, just be a tough guy.
Yeah, which is the pop culture version, sure. Mm. But Holmes makes it really clear that Stoicism wasn't just a coping mechanism or some personality trait. It was a rigorous, systematic philosophy. It was literally a machine designed to process reality.
Right.
And to understand it, we really have to look under the hood at their physics, their honestly weirdly biological view of the soul and their belief that the universe is just a giant rational fire.
It's a survival guide for a collapsing world. And our mission today is to figure out exactly how that guide works. We're going to cover the art of rational detachment, the mechanics of what they call the logos, and finally, the really surprising way this ancient Greek philosophy collided and even merged with early Christianity.
It's a fascinating lineage. But I think to get there, we really have to start where the Stoics started, which is with the problem of pain.
Right, the ethics. Dr. Holmes identifies the core goal of Stoicism as apatheia. Now, immediate red flag for modern ears, that sounds exactly like apathy.
It does.
It sounds like depression. Like, oh, my house is burning down and I just don't care.
Right. And that's a classic false friend in linguistics. In English, apathy implies laziness or a complete lack of concern. But for the Stoics, apatheia meant freedom from passion.
Freedom from passion.
Yes. They viewed passions, things like crippling fear, uncontrolled anger, or overwhelming lust as literal diseases of the mind. They are what happened when you lose control of your reason. So the goal isn't to be a rock or an unfeeling statue.
Right.
It's to be a fortress. You're trying to reach a state where your inner peace is just totally invulnerable to the outer world.
Holmes tells a story about Epictetus that honestly I'm still trying to wrap my head around. It's pretty gruesome.
It is, but it's the defining anecdote for this whole concept. Epictetus was a giant of the movement, but he started his life as a slave in Rome. And the story goes that his master was torturing him, literally twisting his leg to break it.
And most people in that situation would be screaming, you know, begging, bargaining.
Exactly. But Epictetus doesn't scream. He just looks at his master calmly and says, if you keep doing that, you are going to break it. He's just stating a clinical fact about the physics of the bone.
And the master just keeps twisting.
Yep.
Until, snap, the leg breaks.
And Epictetus, without missing a single beat, just says, I told you so.
See, that is where the modern mind just recoils. It feels almost sociopathic. I mean, how do you get from my leg is snapping to I totally come, I told you so? Is he just pretending it doesn't hurt?
No, and that's a crucial distinction Holmes makes here. The Stoic isn't delusional. They feel the physical sensation, but they distinguish between the sensation of pain and the moral evil of being upset by it.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, Epictetus limped for the rest of his life. The pain was very real. But he absolutely refused to let that physical event breach the walls of his mind.
Holmes used a much more relatable example from his own life, which I appreciated. The dentist chair.
Oh, right. Which I think we've all experienced. You're sitting there, mouth pried open. You're super vulnerable. The dentist is drilling. And maybe he hits a nerve. The immediate biological reaction is the sensation of pain. But the immediate emotional reaction is usually, this is bad. I am suffering. Why is this happening to me?
Yeah, I hate this. Get me out of here right now.
Exactly. And the Stoic argues that the get me out of here part is actually a cognitive error. It's a confused idea. Yeah. You are adding a judgment, this is evil, to a totally neutral fact, which is just nerves are firing.
So the dentist stops drilling and asks Holmes, I wonder what a Stoic would say right now.
And the answer is, the Stoic would say the drilling is necessary for health. It is part of the natural order. Therefore, while the sensation is undeniably sharp, the suffering is optional.
Suffering is optional.
Yes. If you use your reason to look at the situation clearly, like, this is just a metal bit touching a tooth, the emotional anxiety just dissipates. You are left with just the raw data.
That phrase, rational control, really seems to be the linchpin here. It sounds like they fundamentally believed you could outthink your own feelings.
They did. They believed emotions are essentially just confused ideas. If you clarify the idea, the emotion vanishes. And this actually anticipates a lot of later philosophy like Spinoza and Descartes. The whole goal is to have clear and distinct ideas about everything. Because if you see the world clearly, you realize there is absolutely nothing to be afraid of.
But wait, I have to challenge this a bit. What? Because seeing the world clearly doesn't necessarily make it less scary. Like, if I see a tiger clearly charging at me, I'm arguably much more afraid. Why does clarity lead to calm for a Stoic?
That is the perfect question, because it leads us directly into the metaphysics. You can't understand their ethics without understanding their view of the universe. The reason you shouldn't be afraid of the tiger or the broken leg or the tyrant is because of what they believed nature actually was.
Living in harmony with nature. That's the phrase, right?
Right. But for them, nature, with a capital N, is synonymous with God. This is pantheism. They didn't believe in a God who sits outside the universe and looks down on it from above. They believed God is the universe, or rather, God is the active principle inside the universe.
Holmes breaks this down into two parts. He talks about the passive and the active.
Yeah, think of it like a body and a soul, but on a massive cosmic scale. The passive is matter. It's inert substance, the clay. The active is the logos.
The logos. That's a word that carries a lot of historical baggage.
It really does. It translates to word or reason. But in the Stoic context, you should think of it as cosmic law. It is the operating system of the universe. It's the force that orders the stars, moves the seasons, and literally dictates every single event that happens on Earth.
So if the logos is reason and the logos controls everything?
Then everything that happens is, by definition, reasonable.
Oh, wow. That is the why. That's why Epictetus accepts the broken leg, because the logos decreed it.
Precisely. The universe is a closed, perfectly determined system. It's a machine. Holmes mentions their concept of the fiery conflagration. They believe the universe goes through these massive cycles. It's created, it runs its entire course based on the logos, and eventually it just burns up in a cosmic fire and starts all over again. It's a rigid loop.
So if I get angry that my car broke down, or that I lost my job.
You are basically shaking your fist at gravity. You are yelling at math.
Yelling at math.
Yeah. That is why it's irrational. Moral evil in Stoicism isn't about breaking a religious commandment. It's acting contrary to nature. It's the refusal to accept your specific role in the machine.
It's a very high-stakes version of it is what it is.
It is exactly that, but with religious intensity. If you fight reality, you are quite literally fighting God.
Now, speaking of God and nature, this leads to the part of the deep dive that really threw me. I think most of you listening, especially if you have any background in Western religion, you think of the soul or the spirit as something immaterial, something ghostly that sort of floats around. But Holmes says the Stoics were materialists, like hardcore materialists.
This is a major stumbling block for modern readers. When we hear materialist today, we think of someone who loves money and buying things.
Right.
But in philosophy, it means you believe only matter exists. The Stoics looked at the world and said, okay, if God interacts with the world and only physical things can push other physical things, then God must be physical.
So God is gas, fire. What is it?
They called it a creative fire or a rational heat. It's a refined, very subtle kind of matter, but it's still definitely matter. And since our souls are little fragments of that God, what they called logos spermaticos, or seeds of the logo, our souls must be physical too.
A seed of the logos. It sounds so poetic until you realize they meant it completely biologically. Holmes brings up a theory called traducianism.
Yes. This is where the physics of the soul gets very, very literal. If the soul is a physical thing, it can't just float down from heaven when a baby is born. It has to be transmitted biologically. They believed the soul was actually contained in the parent seed.
This is the animalculism theory Holmes mentioned. The idea that the offspring is basically prepackaged body and soul in miniature inside the biological material.
It sounds absurd to us now, obviously, knowing what we know about DNA and cellular biology. But logically, within their closed system, it was the only explanation. If the soul is real and all of reality is material, The soul has to be passed down via the body.
And what's wild is that this specific ancient biological theory didn't just die out with the Greeks. It actually solved a massive problem for the early Christians.
This is really the pivot point of the whole lecture. You'd think that a materialist philosophy that says the universe burns down and starts over would be totally incompatible with Christianity. But Holmes explains that the early church fathers were deeply engaged with reading these guys. And one of them, Tertullian, realized that Stoic physics was actually a weapon.
A weapon against who?
Against the Gnostics.
Okay, quick refresher for you on the Gnostics.
So the Gnostics were a sect that believed the physical world was inherently evil. They thought the creator God of the Old Testament was basically a mistake, and that true spirituality meant escaping the body and the physical realm entirely. They absolutely hated matter.
And Tertullian is trying to defend Orthodox Christianity, which says God created the physical world and explicitly called it good.
Right. So Tertullian grabs this Stoic argument. He says, look, even the great pagan philosophers know that the soul is material. They know that matter can be rational and divine. He uses their materialism to validate the physical creation.
And he uses that traducianism, the soul and the seed idea, to explain original sin.
Exactly. It's brilliant theological engineering. If Adam sinned and we were all born with a sinful nature, how did that travel from him thousands of years down to us? If God creates a fresh, totally new soul for every single baby, why would he make it sinful? That just doesn't make sense.
But if the soul is passed down physically,
then the sinful nature is basically just a genetic defect. It's passed down through the generations, exactly like eye color or height. Tertullian used Stoic biology to make Christian theology work on a mechanical level.
That is such a surprising connection. You have this pagan philosophy essentially underwriting a core Christian doctrine. But the connection goes even deeper than that. Holmes takes us to the book of Acts, chapter 17, Paul on Mars Hill.
This is one of the most dramatic confrontations in the history of ideas. You have the Apostle Paul standing in Athens, which is the intellectual center of the world at that time. He's facing off against the Epicureans and the Stoics. And what's brilliant is that he doesn't start by condemning them. He starts by quoting them.
Yeah, he says, "In him we live and move and have our being."
Which is pure Stoic language. He's describing that pantheistic active principle we talked about. God isn't far away. He's the very medium we exist in.
And then he quotes their poets directly. He says, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring.
He's quoting Aratus and Cleanthes there. He's validating their concept of the Logos. He's agreeing with their cosmopolitanism, this idea that all humans share one blood and one universal reason. He builds this incredible intellectual bridge. He's essentially saying, you guys have figured out the structure of the universe. You know there is a law. You know there is a reason. I'm just here to tell you his name.
It sounds like a perfect match.
Yeah.
The Christians get the Logos, the Stoics get a name for their God, but then the bridge just completely collapses.
It collapses instantly. Paul pushes it exactly one step too far for the Stoic mind. He mentions the resurrection of the dead.
And the reaction in the text is immediate mockery.
The room just clears out. And if you understand Stoicism, you understand exactly why. Go back to Epictetus for a second. What is the ultimate goal?
Apatheia. Detachment.
Right. The body is the source of pain. The body is the thing that gets tortured and broken by tyrants. The soul is this divine fire trapped inside the gross clay.
So if you tell a Stoic, good news, you get your physical body back and you're going to live in it forever.
It sounds like a horror movie to them.
Yeah.
It sounds like being told you're going back to prison permanently. To a Stoic, salvation is escaping the body to finally rejoin the cosmic fire. To a Christian, salvation is the ultimate redemption of the body and the renewal of the physical world.
It's a fundamental clash in hope. One hopes for absorption and the other hopes for resurrection.
Exactly. And that was the hard line they couldn't cross. They could agree on ethics, they could agree on the Logos, they could agree on the deep need for order, but they just couldn't agree on the ultimate destiny of the human person.
Despite the breakup there on Mars Hill, Holmes emphasizes that the influence really remained. Stoicism didn't just vanish into history.
No, it stayed completely baked into the DNA of the West. The Stoic idea of natural law, this concept that there is a moral order built into the fabric of the universe that is higher than any human king or any government that became the foundation of Western jurisprudence, it's right there in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That is a profoundly Stoic concept.
So bring this all back to us sitting here in our own chaotic modern version of the Hellenistic period. We have Epictetus coolly ignoring his broken leg. We have the universe as a giant rational machine, and we have this moment where faith and reason really tried to dance together. What is the ultimate takeaway for you listening? Why does Holmes want us to know this?
I think Holmes is showing us that the human search for order is totally timeless. When the world feels like it's falling apart, we crave a system. We want to know that the chaos isn't just meaningless chaos, that there is a logos, a reason behind it all. The Stoics found peace by aligning their internal reason with what they truly believed was the external reason of the universe.
It challenges you to look at your own reactions, doesn't it? When things go wrong, when the dentist hits the nerve, are we reacting with confused ideas or are we seeing the reality clearly?
Right. It's an invitation to audit your own mind. Are you seeing the world exactly as it is, or are you just seeing your fear of it?
And that leads me to a final thought I've really been mulling over since diving into these sources. We touched briefly on their epistemology, how they think we actually come to know things. They believed in the tabula rasa, right? The blank slate.
Yes. The idea that the mind at birth is a blank wax tablet, and the world stamps impressions onto it as you live.
So if that's true, and if the only way to have real peace is to have clear and distinct ideas, it's honestly a terrifying thought. Because think about, what is stamping impressions onto our wax every single day right now? The 24-hour news cycle, social media algorithms, advertising, politicians, they're all just hammering stamps onto our blank slates constantly.
And most of those stamps are the textbook definition of confused ideas. They are quite literally designed to create anxiety and outrage, not clarity.
Exactly. So the Stoic challenge, if we fully applied it to today, is to look at that wax tablet of your mind and seriously ask yourself, how much of what I believe is actually true, and how much is just a messy scribble stamped there by a chaotic society while I wasn't looking?
That is a deeply disturbing question, but you know, it's probably the very first step toward true apatheia.
Oh, check your wax. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
See you next time.